there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of responsibility. I mean, it comes down to responsibility. And in a way, this whole conversation is about responsibility. It's about all of our responsibility for all that's around us and our world and all of that. And the responsibility and the accountability is to set the right direction. When you're taking a direction that is untraveled, it is even more, and therefore highly risky. It is even more difficult to do that with confidence and bring people with you.
You are listening to the Real Leaders Podcast, where leaders keep it real. I'm your host, Kevin Edwards, and that story comes from the co-founder of Reset and chair of Springwise, James Bidwell, who believes in order to change the world, one must assume and inspire a greater role of responsibility. Throughout today's discussion, Bidwell shares how consumers are becoming more conscientious, the threat of big tech on capital markets, and why now is the time to reset your own path. So without further interruption, may I introduce to you episode 187 with the real James Bidwell. Enjoy. Show and ask questions. Be a part of the show. Hit that link and come on over here to the live stream and say hello to James and myself. But with that being said, folks, let's get this show on the road here. Here we go now. In 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Real Leaders Podcast. I am your host, Kevin Edwards. Joining us today is the co-founder of Reset and owner and chair of Springwise, Mr. James Bidwell. James, thanks for being with us today.
Fantastic to be here, Kevin. Thanks for inviting me. Very excited to talk to you today.
I'm thrilled. Your reputation precedes you. I hope that our audience can get to know you a little bit better here today, James, and how you think, why you've made the choices you've made in your career. So let's start with this. I'm going to jump right into it. What is the purpose of business to you?
So the purpose of business to me has changed significantly since I started out, 25 years ago. Today, it is really simple. It is to be a force for change and a force for positive change and a force for dealing with many of the problems that we have in the world, but at the same time, making it a more equitable, prosperous, climate-friendly world to live in. And business, because of the failure of governments to really get on this agenda and really make the right change happen, I think business has a unique opportunity and role and purpose. And that has changed from when I started in my business career, which when it was the purpose of business was really only to make money. And it's very exciting after all those years to see modern business being more purposeful. Not all of it, of course. We're just at the beginning of those changes. I do believe in them.
James, I'm going to attempt to dissect what you just said and ask you a few questions based on your answer. What agenda are we talking about here? Is there an end goal for the force for good? And when you say goal, what are we trying to achieve here? What is the ultimate objective?
So look, I mean, I think we could spend a long time dissecting that and we could go down many, many routes. The route that I feel most passionately about is the issue of climate change and the sustainability agenda. And it is clear that if we do not solve that fairly rapidly, and you live in California, so you're sitting in a state with ravaged by fires that are more and more extreme every year. I'm here in Europe and we have our own problems. And it is man-made. You know, we are polluting our world. We are delivering carbon into the world that cannot be sucked out. And we're the lucky ones. So we could go and talk about some of the places in the world where there is mass migration that is caused by climate change, droughts, and all of those things. So if humanity is going to survive and prosper in generations to come, this generation needs to act, and we need to act now. And I know I'm not the only person talking about this, which is good, but there are still too many people who aren't talking about it. And so for me, business has an opportunity to push that agenda and solve this, the most pressing problem that we have as a human race.
Okay, so ultimate objective, reduce climate change, at least to a point that it doesn't affect mankind. Is that the goal, to save mankind? Is the goal to restore the lands, to save species? What do you think is going to drive this economy when it comes to sustainability and social impact and the entrepreneurs that are innovating around the world? What do you think is going to drive them to do something like this?
It's such a great question, Kevin, because the interesting thing is that nature, Mother Nature, will probably be okay. It's just us humans that won't be. So if there is catastrophic climate change, nature will reinvent itself. And I was watching a program about the redwoods last night, actually, and you know how they have this incredible ability to withstand generations and generations and still come back, but the human race doesn't have that ability. What will drive it, and this is the exciting thing, and this is what I work on most of my time now, is the intersection of innovation and creativity with addressing this problem. So the use of innovation technology to drive the change and come up with the solutions. So the thing about climate change is we haven't got all the solutions yet, but we are moving, you know, rapidly towards finding those solutions. And then, of course, that the objective is for businesses to actually deploy them. But I believe innovation, and which has accelerated significantly in the last year with COVID, and because a lot of people have been forced to innovate, will be part of that solution. But business to put its power, its money, its influence and impact behind those innovations in order to deploy them to make radical change.
There's an agenda out there called the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. We are partners of and signatories of. We go to conferences, or at least we used to, in New York, to hear people from the General Assembly speak around the world about these topics. Do you see any flaws in this goal setting? And when I say this, this is where I'm coming from, James. I'm coming from the angle of, if you're trying to live a healthy lifestyle, you don't tell yourself you're going to lose 20 pounds. Because we all know when you lose 20 pounds, you're going to gain that right back. And even faster, you may even become more out of shape, out of weight. It's a mindset change you have to do with yourself first. The goal is the wrong goal. So do you see any flaws in this goal by 2030?
Look, I think the goals are an admirable framework, and it's very, very useful to have something that is globally recognized as a framework, and a framework which identifies the issues, as you say, and breaks them down. And we are also signatories. But the real thing is, I think this is what you're getting at, Kevin, is translating that into reality. Right. And in a business context, translating that into a reality which is palatable for the shareholders, the staff, the customers, and all of those things. And that's where the B Corp movement comes in. And we're proud B Corp for both Springwise and Reset. And what the B Corp makes you do is to sign up to a framework and accountability, if you like, which forces you to change the way you do business. And it forces you to consider all stakeholders. It forces you to look at diversity. It forces you to look at carbon, your carbon impact, your circularity. All of those issues are then through the accreditation, and it is a tough accreditation. It took us 15 months to get to, but now we have a new structure for the way we run our business, which is dedicating it to positive change. And the reason I as a shareholder, I'm happy about that, is because at the moment it gives me huge competitive advantage. So I'm better than the big consultancies, because they can't say that they're a B Corp, because they're doing all sorts of stuff that they shouldn't do. They don't talk about it much, but it does get in the press. And it helps me attract the best teams, so the best talent, because, and this is a topic we could talk more about later, but the next generation of leaders and the next generation of talent really care about this issue and really care about a more purposeful business environment than just the old paradigm of making lots of money for investors and that's it.
So when you're saying the purpose of business is to be a business as a force for good, And we've got what, you know, spring-wise for people listening out there, accelerator, social entrepreneurs coming in, you're giving them advice, you're giving them connections, you're growing their organization like an incubator program. What stands out to you among the successful companies, and what is the new mentality like you just alluded to in terms of this focus on more than just the bottom line?
It's a great idea. So for those of you who are listening who don't know what Springwise is, and it's easy to look at, but at springwise.com, it's a global network of innovators and innovations. And the Springwise editorial team publish the top innovations that they see around the world every day. So we publish the top three each day. And the idea is that, first of all, those innovators get oxygen of meet an audience of maybe 100,000 people every couple of weeks with their innovation. And then the people who are interested and curious about the innovations that are going to come through and drive the change that is needed, Springwise is the place to go to it. So the thing that strikes me, and I've been involved with Springwise for 5 years, is that over that time, the change from, in those days, it was like, it was kind of more like a product hunt kind of thing. It was, you know, lots of new ideas. It was quite a lot of it was startups that were kind of going to make lots of money and lots of tech. And what's shifted is that the type of innovator that is coming through are those who are really inventing innovations that are going to make change to people's lives and help on the sustainability agenda. So examples like, you know, seaweed packaging, new ways of kind of trapping carbon, all of those kind of new ideas that are really dedicated to kind of making the world a better place, as well as making successful entrepreneurs. And the rise in the ESG agenda, which we know about, has kind of driven a movement, and particularly amongst entrepreneurs who are kind of almost have that in their DNA, some of the new entrepreneurs coming through, where they're really care about the social impact, the positive impact, rather than just making the money.
Do you believe they get into business to change the world, or do they get in the business to make money and change the world?
So I'm just involved in a little business which is called Spherix in the UK, which has just launched, and the founder definitely wants to make money, but he's going to do it through changing the world. And I think where I look at it, and I'm a bit like that, you know, I'd like to make money as well, and we do well, and we're profitable, and we're successful, so we can pay our teams well, and you know, we're not sort of waiting for handouts. We do the best work around on innovation and sustainability. But at the same time, we give 1% of our sales to 1% of the planet, and we do a lot of good things with that, and we influence a lot of senior leaders to make the changes in their businesses that they need to do, and we convince them by helping them understand how they're going to make more money, rather than, you know, hitting them on the head with, you know, you must do sustainability because the world's going to end. It's a very sound business strategy. So I think this new generation are marrying us with profit, and the clever CEOs are doing that.
When it comes to, you mentioned tech as an investor, like, is tech shiny for you?
Well, tech is for me an enabler. So most businesses that we look at do have tech in them, and they need to have, you know, if they're reaching a lot of customers or they have ambitions to scale. And so tech is more of an enabler than a kind of means to an end. We look at it, we understand it. It's definitely an enabler, and there's good sides and bad sides, but most businesses that we would look at from an investment point of view, if you believe you want to scale something, you're going to be technology. Technology is going to sit in the middle of that.
So for entrepreneurs listening to this out there, when it comes to tech, when it comes to an algorithm or some type of IP, what sticks out to you as an investor? Is it the IP? Is it that it's their own? Is it that it's adaptable, and or is it that it's just the core functionality of the tech that they're using that's going to expand their reach? Like, what about tech should a social entrepreneur be looking into?
So as an investor, the first thing that I always look at, as you can imagine, I'm going to say this is the team. You know, the team are always going to be what's going to make the success. And in terms of how they would look at tech, I think it's do that. You know, how are you going to make your proposition, your customer proposition, you know, reach more people, be more efficient, be more effective through the use of technology? So I would start with the customer. Who is your customer? And then how are you going to enable your business to scale and be a brilliant business through the use of technology? So that's always how I look at it, is what is the proposition? Who's the buyer? Who's going to give you money for it one day? And therefore, you know, what do you need to do to get that to happen?
When it comes to the customer, then, if you're building a business around a customer, do you believe that customers in today's day and age are going to pay more on average for a sustainable premium product versus something at a lower price?
I think some customers will. And so examples are, you know, the well-worn example is Patagonia, where they have a premium customer base, you know, relatively expensive clothes, which I love. And, you know, they have always put the purpose before the profit. And of course, they've now ended up as a very profitable business. So often these trends start in the more luxury high-end space. And, you know, there are people with more money, and, you know, you can look at the travel industry and people would like to go and stay in nice, sustainable, eco-friendly hotels, you know, but they're expensive. The question is when that moves into the mass market, and, you know, can you go shopping on the high street and buy a t-shirt for £5? And can you have sustainability baked into that? And would someone pay £5 for a sustainable t-shirt and £4 for a, you know, for when they could get one that's exactly the same but not sustainable for £4, for example, or $4? Sorry to be in the English currency. We still have it. So look, I think it's going to come because I think it will become the norm. And I think what, yeah, but I think at the moment there is choices, and some people just simply can't afford to spend money on, you know, they don't have the money. And I think the responsibility of businesses is to bake in sustainability to their whole supply chain in order that they can still deliver their $4 t-shirt, but it's a sustainable one where the people in the supply chain are paid the right amount of wages, and the cotton isn't polluting rivers and all of those sorts of things. And my experience here is that, and I think actually Europe's quite good on, you know, leading on some of these things, is that there are brands who are really doing a lot of work on this, and they're mass brands. And when, of course, you get the critical mass of three or four big, say, $5, $10 billion brands doing those changes, then you can shift the whole industry. And not only is that good for all of the people involved in the chain of the supply chain and the industry, but also for customers. And it's a very strong competitive advantage, because if you've got scale, you can do it at the right cost. So it's a complicated answer to your question, but I believe that yes, people will pay a premium now, there's evidence, and that will go into the broader mass market over time.
Interesting. And what also is interesting to me is that Patagonia is a privately held organization. And so when you're talking about those other organizations who are going to get together and make this change and change the industry, most of the time these are just privately held organizations with private funds, not publicly traded, where you do have a fiduciary responsibility to maximize shareholder value. Do you think, now you mentioned the stakeholders, maximizing stakeholder value and including those and incorporating them, and the ultimate shift that you can have within your community, within your customers, within your supply chain. You've touched on all those different points. But are we really going to see the change that we need to have in this world if public corporations are going to continuously make decisions that are going to produce quality products at a lower price than Patagonia?
It's the key question, Kevin. And I always, you know, like you just have, say, it's fantastic that Yvon Chouinard has been able to remain private. And probably he always says, you know, if I wasn't private, I wouldn't have been able to do all this stuff, because my shareholders would have kicked me out. what I'm seeing in the UK and in Europe, which is very encouraging, is that the investment community are now taking this seriously, and they are now thinking about this and putting pressure on their CEOs of the businesses where they have big holdings to look at sustainability as more than what it has historically been, was an ESG box ticking, kind of just go through the motions and make as much money as possible. There is a fundamental shift that is required, which is the Articles of Association, we call them in the UK, which is what B Corp make you do, which is they make you consider planet and all these other stakeholders. And at the moment, the listed companies don't have to do that. But the investors have a lot of clout, as we all know. It's the guys and girls with the money, but it's normally guys, unfortunately, are definitely getting onto this. But the other thing I would say, and I see this working with some of the CEO clients that we work with on Reset, where we develop strategies for sustainability, is when they see that their customers and their staff are really positive about this agenda and really want to make this agenda happen, you can almost see the changes coming. And that, of course, then is a competitive advantage, and it's good for retention of people, and it makes the business more successful. So you do need to translate that into profit and increase profit. And perhaps more importantly, particularly as we've just been through COVID, or we're still going through it, is the resilience point. So I would argue that businesses that are more purpose-driven are more resilient. And we have an example here that we have something called a furlough scheme in the UK, which is where the government bailed out, when companies shut because they had to shut because of COVID. And B Corps were required much less support from governments than the average company. Now, that's a bit of a generalization, and some are big and some are small and all of that, but it's a direction of travel, and it's a green shoot, if you like, that shows that companies who are operating along these lines are beginning to be successful and beginning to break through.
It seems like that is the case throughout these last couple of years when it comes to also the cancel culture. It seems like the companies that are more purpose driven are less likely to take the heat, if you will. So I think from another standpoint with social media and tech, it's also just a great thing to know and be transparent with your organizations. How does transparency impact your organization from an employee level to a consumer products level as well?
Look, I mean, transparency is it's a big buzzword, and it's great. It's a great to talk about and hard to do. Mm. I think we've seen a lot of certainly in the big corporations, the kind of the pay transparency and all of those kind of discussions, which remain always a big issue at the shareholder meetings. I think what I feel is, in terms of leadership, and there's some. A great CEO who's running one of the biggest beauty businesses in the world, and it's a good friend of mine. And he has a very flat leadership style, so he has a very transparent leadership style. And he's it's a very progressive in the environmental side of things as well. And so it's a much flatter structure. It's a much more collaborative. And therefore, by definition, it's more transparent. And that transparency of decision making is kind of outsourced a little bit from the office of the CEO and goes through into the whole of the organization, and that drives accountability, and it creates a framework or a model which is, I think, easier to manage in some ways because it's much more agile. So with transparency and honesty and trust, you can be more agile because you can move quicker when you need to move quicker, and you can rely on people to do that. Mm. So I'm always very impressed when I hear him talk about his business, and he's been very successful in growing that business. So it's successful as a commercial venture. It's also, I think, it's listed, but it's majority controlled by a family.
When it comes to agility, we saw that companies that had remote workplaces during COVID were very agile. They're able to adapt quite well with not being able to see each other and be face to face, had that social contact. Now, SpringWise, you have scouts all around the world. What are some things that you see coming in terms of decentralization, mobility, the global citizen, the global consumer, the global company? What does that look like 10 years down the road for you?
I think 10 years, quite a long time to get me to try to predict, Kevin. But yeah, 5 years old. So look, I think there's going to be significant change. We do quite a lot of work with the City of London in looking at how cities are going to evolve, how neighborhoods are going to evolve. I think there is a huge push towards local. And, you know, there's a city in the UK now that they're going to try and make it into the 15-minute city, so you can get to anything you need within a 15-minute walk. The age of the car in the city has got to be going as soon as possible. It's ridiculous. 98% of the time the cars in London are not used. They're sitting cluttering up the streets. And as someone said, that car park space would be a brilliant place to have a game of table tennis, etc. So the greening of cities, the localization of growing food, I think, is really interesting in some city spaces, and that's being trialed. We see that quite a lot. And the way people get around. So in COVID, what it's allowed people to do is to develop this kind of remote working. And I think that people still want to go to the office. And our guys, we've got 25 people, and they want to go back to the office. We want to see each other. But we don't need to be in the office every day, you know, 5 days a week and all of that. So the use of space, and how do you design space for the next, for the post-COVID era, is going to be a brilliant challenge for the architects, you know, the architects who are thinking about all of that now. And it will be very different. The landlord has had a fantastic run of things, because it's the landlords have been fairly passive. They've let their building, and then they're full of people in offices or full of retailers, 10-year leases and all of that kind of stuff. And what's exciting is they now need to be much more creative to think about, you know, how people are going to behave. So I see a hybrid model emerging. I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. I see cars being eliminated slowly out of cities, and Amsterdam are doing a lot of that at the moment. It's they charge a huge amount if you want to have a car in a city. Mm. We need regulation and tax to do that. And of course, in Europe, we can do that easier than you can in the States, because we have great sort of central city center infrastructure. Whereas I know in California and LA that you need a car, you're not going to be getting around without that. So how does that look? What would the innovation be? Is it Hyperloop on steroids or something else? Again, innovation will play a big role in cutting the carbon from cars and making life palatable and easy for the next stage.
So when it comes to innovation, when it comes to change, market change, to you, James, who controls the markets, the consumers or the suppliers?
It's a very good question. I mean, I'm always someone who listens to the customer. But I'm very aware, particularly in a world where we are very dominated by what Facebook thinks. I think it's a difficult question. So it should be the consumer, but is it the purveyor of information? And an example, I think you have some listeners in Australia, but I was very dismayed to hear this morning that Facebook have cut a deal with Rupert Murdoch's media empire to buy their content in order to be able to put news out in Australia. So effectively, the only lens of news on Facebook in Australia is Rupert Murdoch. And I'm not political, particularly, but I'm not making a political point. But I think it is extremely distressing to hear that news. So consumers should, you look at what's going on in Myanmar, and we're getting into a slightly hectic territory here. But the people are saying we're not going to be run by a military government, or a kind of martial law and all of that. So there is a theme that I see a lot in our work, and is the theme of the activist. And activists like Greta Thunberg, who I have great admiration for, are helping wake up the most I guess, the most enlightened leaders, and, you know, and helping us trigger and stimulate the change that we really, really need. And we do need a world, you know, a way to kind of unlock some of this, you know, into a more equitable world, and on Greta's agenda, a world where we recognize that the world's on fire and actually do something about it.
Right. Yes, absolutely. It's got to come from the leadership level, the board decision-making level, the shareholder level, right? But I'm also of the opinion that, you know, someone that interviews conscious companies on a weekly basis, you know, it's still easy to do unconscious things as a consumer. I'm flawed. I'm a human. I make flawed decisions all the time. Can we trust and expect that consumers, you know, are going to follow these changes, that everyone on the world is going to see, you know, things differently? And I know that's a big statement, but if we're really about what change we want, we have to change our perspective, and then we have to change our behaviors. And behavior change to make better actions is one of the most difficult things to do in business. Change a consumer's behavior. How have your behaviors changed, James, since you've learned about plant-based meat, since you've learned about carbon emissions? How has your behavior changed since you learned about what's going on in the world?
So I have radically changed the way I travel. So I fly very little. I still do fly a bit, fly much, much less, go by train in Europe where I can. I have an electric car sitting here. And some people will say, you know, your battery is, you know, not eco-friendly and all of that kind of stuff. But what I believe is that people will see me driving it to the school to pick up the kids, and they'll be embarrassed about their Range Rovers or BMWs or whatever, and they'll think, actually, maybe I'll get one of those. It looks quite fun. We have. Sorry,
I said smart.
And we have at home. We order most of our food comes from a really cool organization, which is a vegetable box company, which the guy started with a wheelbarrow and some onions 40 years ago, and now he's got about 150 million turnover. Wow. He recently sold his or gave his business to his employees so that they could continue it. So it's employee owned. It's a B corporation, and they deliver boxes of vegetables. They came today. It's called Riverford Organic. So we get the majority of our food from there. We eat very little red meat, or very little meat in the house, which is a big change. I have a little stream in my garden, and I'm rewilding that for the nature and all of those kind of things. So, and I buy mainly organic kind of or eco-friendly clothes. So I'm there's Patagonia. I've got a lot of that, and then I have there's a lovely brand in Cornwall in the UK, which is down the west, called Finisterre, which is a similar the UK version of Patagonia. There's another Scandinavian brand of jeans called Nudie, which is organic denim. So I think a lot about all of that. I haven't managed to stop the relentless deliveries of Amazon. So I haven't quite got that out of our system in our house, but I'm trying my best. And then, you know, in COVID, of course, it's been, there's no cardboard in Europe anymore because it's all been used for the Amazon deliveries and the home deliveries. So I think I'm, you know, doing more than I ever have. And I probably could do even more, but a lot of what I do is impacting through our work, through the Springwise Network, through the Reset Consultancy, in order to persuade people that this is the right path. Can I pick up on one other thing? Because it's really important. And you mentioned it at the end of the last question, but it's about leadership and the leaders. And where I am really most excited, and I see it in our business and I see it in our client businesses, is the next generation of leaders. So the people who are going to be, you know, the CEOs in 5 or 10 years. So they're in their 20s, 30s, coming through. And I see them with a completely different attitude to people my age. So I'm kind of the age of the CEOs of the moment. I'm in my mid 50s, and the majority of whom I don't think really are taking the purpose agenda very seriously. And I think they're they've had a great life. We've all had made, you know, plenty of money and all of that. But I do see the next generation as being really, I'm really excited by that. And so a lot of my mission is to encourage them and help them get set to kind of be the leaders that of future businesses where environment and the B Corp values are in the center of that. So I'm really excited about that. And your fantastic motto, inspire the future. I'm inspired by the future of the younger leaders and your generation.
Well, I think it's a mix of both. I think it's never just one generation. Everyone has to come together at some point, as you know, as well. And I also see it from a lens of, you know, we have to get, and I'm going to say the G word, we have to get greedy about doing good. I think we have to make products so good and make sure that our customers cannot deny the product so that we can make change in the world. Like, think about it. Facebook, we talked about tech, our dislike for Facebook. Whether we like it or not, we're posting this video on Facebook later on. You know, we're still eating out of the poisonous apple that's given to us. We when is the change going to happen? And it has to come from a better product. So like a Clubhouse coming out, could that be something that makes those right decisions? The innovation, when we talk about what's the ultimate change you want in the future, that's what innovation is. It's the ultimate objective to change the future. So tech is something that's interesting to me because, you're back now. So tech is something that's interesting to me, James. And I just want you to just be with me here a little bit while I'm trying to unravel my thoughts out of my head with tech. Tech has changed the model. And to me, I think, you know, when you started out and you're learning about entrepreneurship, you know, you're trying to build a product and people think they have to find investors first. No, you have to find the customers first. And then you think about Facebook, it's like, wow, they just had all these free customers with no business model. And they're just able to just get investors and just have tons of debt and just grow this thing to a proportion that they now have a monopoly on media in the world. And it's a product of capitalism. So really what we're not fighting here is socialism. Socialism always been capitalism's, you know, foe, but really it's the child of capitalism that is going to overtake it right now. And it is an interesting way to think about how we see tech and algorithms and repetitive cycles evolving, taking over human jobs. Really, it's capitalism doing it to itself. So that's something I just want you to marinate on. And I want to hear your thoughts kind of on how you see tech being regulated or it maybe changing capitalism in a sense.
Wow. It's such a big topic. And perhaps the most scary is the kind of the algorithms and the AI and the taking over humanity in a way that is being talked about, and whether it comes or not. Look, I think also the tech investment community who have managed to persuade investors that it's about valuation as opposed to profit, which has completely upended the normal business model. And Amazon, of course, is a great example of that. Although, of course, they do make money now, but the ability to grow businesses that are just based on valuation because they're tech businesses, and so the capitalist markets are behind all of that. Regulation, I think the EU are doing a reasonably good job. Europe are doing a reasonably good job at looking at some of the tax implications of the mainly US giants operating in Europe, and frankly not paying the tax that is due, although legally it is due. It isn't, you know, legally they're not doing anything wrong, but you know, the amount of money that is being spent through those platforms, and the, you know, it's the model is wrong because there's no incentive to kind of change it at the moment. And regulation has to be part of that. And so breaking up some of these businesses that are hugely dominant, and in a way the regulator is often quite a long way behind the businesses, so they're playing catch up, and it's a massive issue for us. And I mean, you know, the impact on the mental health of young people, in particularly in COVID, of social media and the, you know, the refusal to admit it. Sorry, I've got to drink a bit of water here.
No, take your time.
Excuse me.
That's an interesting point. I want to stay on that. Continue.
Yeah. So yeah. So is really disappointing. And I mean, I was in advertising for a while, and you look at the advertising industry, and they're, you know, you talk the products. They're selling sugar to kids. You know, wrapped up in nice packaging, and you know, it, of course, it looks nice, and of course, it tastes nice, and it's, you know, brilliantly addictive. And you know, look at the obesity levels, look at the all of those issues. And social media is a similarly more addictive. And you know, there's loads of examples of where it's gone horribly wrong. So, but on the flip side, of course, we're enabled by social media, and a very good side to it as well. So it's an ongoing debate that needs to be debated.
It's very scary, yes, because think about it like this. And I was listening to an episode from the guy who made that movie on Netflix, The Social Dilemma. And he was talking, obviously, he was saying that, you know, even the creators of these algorithms don't let their own children use it. That right then and there, we should know how dangerous these things actually are. But it's also scary in the sense that social media let's just put it this way. We know a magician is doing a trick on us. We know that they know that they know the weak parts of our brain. We know that they're doing a trick, yet they're still able to fool us. So when you hear that the customer is actually the consumer of the content, we know we're the consumer of the content, yet it's still able to trick us. And that's the scariest part for me. We can't do anything about it because they know our brain so well. They have it down to a T. Google does as well. I can send an email out and it'll know if it's a promotion, actual primary email, an update without a blink of the eye. So when it comes to knowing people so well, are we just going to go in this continuous cycle? And is there anything to change that? Because these are things that have evolved for, you know, humanity and society over hundreds of thousands of years. And in 10, you know, 20 plus years, we've got a system that can figure us out so well. And it doesn't look like it's going to be able to change. And the reason for that being is because they're going to continue to make money, and they want to continue to make money.
So. It's terrifying. And you know, you or I know this, and we can say, well, we know that we've given all this data, and you know, we'll take it because we want, you know, Google's useful and social media is useful, etc. And I think that the problem is, you know, is the kids, because they don't know that. They don't, you know, and however much they say it, they still want to be on, you know, want to be connected, and they are not protected properly, which is a massive problem. I think a lot of this is around education, and a lot of this conversation actually that we're having points to a kind of a reset of the education that children are given to inform them more about some of these inherent dangers, to inform them more about climate change and that agenda. There's a topic at my children's school called Global Awareness, which is a fantastic topic that actually talks about some of these macro issues. And we need to, you know, I have five children, three children and two step children, and my job is their education. And it's not just sending them to school, but it's preparing them for a world in which they can have a happy life and thrive and contribute and all of those things. It's much harder than my day job in my business. And it is the critical thing is preparing generations for this world where, you know, there are some evil forces at work, and money is the most evil of all those forces in many ways. And we've allowed it to dominate. So particularly, and I think in the kind of American culture of business, it's all about money. And there's nothing else. There's not even a conversation about anything else.
I think it's about money. I also think it's about shaming. I think it's about value shaming. Think about parenting for a second. shaming your son because, or his daughter, because they're doing things that are innate to them or don't align with your values. It's what puts us in these flocks of groups where we want to be a part of something that's right. And you mentioned this at the very beginning of the show is, you know, reset, you know, we're taking a different path. And I think that's what people need to do, is take a different path. The road less traveled, you know, that's what's going to cure this. Because if we continue to go in this route that's consistent with any human nature cycle, we want to get together, we want to socialize, we want to be popular, we want to be cool, we want to be a part of what's going on. I think COVID is the moment to do it. I think COVID had us locked down. As much as I didn't like it, maybe you didn't like it, maybe you didn't like it, but it's a reset for us, and to use your yep. great name, to really rethink what type of path we're on and to stop the nonsense.
Could not agree more. And in my case, I was on a path that was probably not so good, and I was working for big corporations, and it was hard to make the change. And it was three, 5 years ago. So it was before we had the opportunity for the COVID reset. And without a doubt, this is a unique, the COVID opportunity. You have to sort of look at it as an opportunity, although of course it's hugely distressing for the people who've been caught up in it and the people who've lost loved ones and people who are still in it. But as a global society and a global group of leaders, if you like, this is the time to grab the opportunity and take that path that is a different path, and a path that is, the right path, in inverted commas, but the path that is going to, because we all know, I think, in our heart of hearts, we know what the right path is. And to have that positive impact. And again, we come back to the point that business is so important in the world, and it's such a brilliant way of making change happen, because it has so many constituent parts, it's got so many people involved in it, and you have the scale, and the difference between business and government is that business is global. There's no global government, but there is global business. Now, a business like Unilever with a fantastic CEO, Alan Jope, he's making a lot of great changes globally, and he can do that on a global scale where governments can't. And so we need more of that, and we need to encourage that. And it can be lonely. And sometimes CEOs don't make it when they're on the purposeful path, because the investors get them before they can prove it. But I do believe that, I'm convinced that businesses that do take the path less traveled will be the successful ones, and they'll be much more resilient going forward.
You made an interesting point there that CEOs are lonely. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand. Could you elaborate for our audience why your position is lonely as a CEO, and also maybe how it's unique as a socially conscious CEO in that sense?
Well, look, I'm really lucky that I have an amazing co-founder. Sorry about that, Kevin. I have a great co-founder in Sophie and a great team of people around me. So I'm less lonely than others, but I have been in corporations where I've been a CEO, and I've been very lonely. And I think there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of responsibility. I mean, it comes down to responsibility. And in a way, this whole conversation is about responsibility. It's about all of our responsibility for all that's around us and our world and all of that. And the responsibility and the accountability is to set the right direction. When you're taking a direction that is untraveled, it is even more, and therefore highly risky. It is even more difficult to do that with confidence and bring people with you. And that's where I think experience is really useful. So my confidence came from a lot of experience, and I can feel the market well because I'm a consumer facing kind of leader, and I know what's coming because I can see out. And Springwise, of course, helps us look into the future a little bit. But I see this transition economy, if you like, transitioning from the old way and into the new way, and that means energy consumption, the way we eat, the way we live, and all of those things. And to be a consultancy with Reset in the middle of that transition economy there's so much investment that's going to be going into all of that change that it's going to be a great, it is a great place to be, and we're already proving it. But we got into it slightly in advance of that market coming, so it was a bit scary. So that's lonely, because you're taking those decisions, and essentially you're saying to people, you know, your livelihoods depend on our business, and I'm taking you in a direction which is uncomfortable. It's not obvious. It's not a well-trodden path, but we're going to go for it. And the good news is we've recruited people who are entrepreneurial, so they get it and they want to go for it. And we have in our recruitment, we say you can't just have done the consultancy. You need to have done something a bit more entrepreneurial and a bit more scary in your past in order to be with us. And then, of course, we can service our clients better because we have that, you know, we have that understanding of risk and doing things differently.
James, it's inspiring to hear you say something like that. And it's a story that is told, unfortunately, too many times. Too many times people get to a point in their lives and, you know, what am I really doing with it? Why aren't I on the right path? And so when it comes to finding the path, what are some things you work on with young entrepreneurs, you know, wise entrepreneurs, people who want to make a difference, want to make a change in their career? How do you make sure that they are on the right path, as you call it?
Look, I spend a lot of time talking to younger people, and I kind of make it a point that if someone wants advice and they send me an email, then I'll always talk to them. And I find that some of the most rewarding conversations that that I have. And I had one today of a lady who was running so she was on the path of not-for-profit. So she was running one of the 1% for the Planet charities, and she'd moved, she'd stopped doing that, and she wanted some advice on, you know, on what to do next. And for me, it's about, you know, thinking about all the ingredients that are going to make you fulfilled. So it's not it's a set of ingredients that then turn into a path. And in the end, people need to make their own minds up. But helping them think about those ingredients and helping think about the amount of impact that they're going to be able to have, you know, the amount of money that they need to earn, because we're all, let's face it, we need to live. So I managed to, she turned a job down because of the conversation, and she's gone, you know, gone on to keep going to look because she didn't find those ingredients. And that was really nice to hear, because everyone's satisfaction is different. But recently I've also spoken to quite a lot of people coming out of university and school, and some of those wondering about, you know, what path to take, and encouraging them to consider sustainability as a career choice, which is relatively new. And certainly there's a great foundation on circularity called the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, encouraging them to go to the Ellen MacArthur Foundation to learn about that, to do a course. And I can say to them confidently, if you do that and then you come back and see me, you know, we're going to be very interested in someone with that qualification. And therefore, we're not the only one, because a lot of businesses are building out their sustainability areas. And so encouraging that. And then we have one fantastic lady who's an intern at Reset at the moment. And she said she was unsure about what she wanted to do. And she said, you know, I'm so excited to be here because, you know, I'm living my purpose every day. This is like amazing. I never thought I could do that in a job, you know. And for me, that's the best output of all, is we're encouraging young people to come with us on this path. And when I'm long gone, they'll be leading the world and, you know, and making a lot more impact. And we would have started that.
Well, let's hope. Let's hope. I hope they, you know, can make that decision during that inception point, before they go down a path that wasn't theirs to begin with. James, you just said responsibility is a major theme of this discussion. I think that's spot on. I think most of the conversations we've talked about today really boils down to that responsibility at either level of a value chain or your stakeholders. So James Bidwell, the last question I have for you today on this show is, what is your definition of a real leader?
So in a nutshell, it's a leader with purpose, because that's what a real leader is. And a real leader, you should be able to look at them and understand what their purpose is, and they should be showing that in everything they do. And a really good leader is one that has the right purpose.
Exactly right. Well, let's work on those purpose statements, folks, after this episode. Thank you for being here today, folks, and listening to this conversation with James. James, appreciate you coming on. I knew this was going to be an interesting discussion today. We went everywhere around the show, and I hope that people enjoy it as much as I did. So for James Bidwell, I'm Kevin Edwards, asking you to go out there, lead with purpose, and always, folks, keep it real. Thanks, James.
Thank you, Kevin. It's been brilliant.
All right. And thank you, good people, for hanging on to this episode of the Real Leaders Podcast with James Bidwell. We hope you enjoyed it. And folks, if you want to hear the rest of James's answers, well, you have to be a part of our free community where you can unlock access to live interviews and ask the guests your direct questions after the show. All you have to do to register for an upcoming episode is go online to realleaders.com/podcast and click on any upcoming interview. Also, folks, if you're listening to this episode on Apple Podcasts, please help a leader out and leave us a review. Let us know what you liked, what you thought about the episode, and how we can improve. And lastly, if you know of any leader who is driving change in your community, please email us directly at b@real-leaders.com. That's b@real-leaders.com. That's it for me. Thanks for being a real leader, and stay tuned for the next episode.